This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, we begin a series that imagines Mount Rushmore with notables from various walks of life for our first installment, American Women.
Plus, a Sunday devoted to soup in Springdale, and guitarist Kevin So offers us a preview before his concert in Fayetteville this weekend.
First on this edition of Ozarks at Large, a legislative bill filed last week would require all property taxes collected by the state for public school districts to be returned to the school district in which they were collected. The current law limits districts to what's called the uniform rate tax minimum of $6,023 per student. Last year, four districts, including Eureka Springs, took in excess money and were ordered by the state to return it. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, they claim the funding ought to stay in local coffers.
Last November, four Arkansas school districts, Armorell in Mississippi County, Westside in Claiborne County, Fountain Lake in Garland County, and Eureka Springs in Carroll County, were told by the Arkansas Department of Education to pay back almost $2.6 million in state-required educational millage revenue. The state collects the money via a 25-mil property tax mandated by the Arkansas Constitutional Amendment 74. In turn, it pays out $6,023 per student for a state Supreme Court-required adequate education. While most of Arkansas's 245 districts take in less, the balance is also provided by the state. Four districts counted in overage. Wayne Carr is superintendent of Eureka Springs School District.
We have a large assessment base. Our property is, we have a high assessment. And the second thing is we have a large number of retired people in our district, so we have a high assessment and a rather low enrollment in our school. And that's what causes us to collect more money per student than some other districts.
So Eureka Springs School District, with 650 K-12 students, generated $7,261 per student. The discrepancy was discovered last summer. Eureka Springs has until June 15th to return its share of the money, $825,000.
What part of the code says, it says for each school district, each county treasurer shall remit the net revenues from the uniform rate of tax to each local school district from which the revenues were derived. So that doesn't say it would be redistributed. There is a subsection B that says, or to other school districts. But from what I read, the money should be distributed back to the district in which the tax was collected.
Superintendent Carr is referring to, by the way, subsections in Arkansas Code Annotated 26-80-101, if you want to look it up. He contacted his state representative for help. That would be Brian King, Republican District 91, which covers all of Carroll County and part of Boone County. King wrote a letter requesting the Attorney General's office for clarification, citing the Arkansas Code conflict. That opinion is pending. Brian King last week also filed House Bill 1435 to amend the Arkansas Code to make school districts retain net millage revenue. He was to present it to the assigned House Education Committee Wednesday, but is holding off.
Well, basically, we have decided not to run the bill at this time. We have discovered some language through private attorneys and through our bureau attorneys that we feel like that we're going to pose to the Attorney General some more questions that we don't feel like maybe he addressed this, and we have sent the new language to the Attorney General that clearly outlines that all local revenues or the revenues collected locally are to be remitted back to the district that they originate from. I mean, that language is pretty clear.
More than a dozen co-sponsors have signed on to the legislation, including representatives from other affected districts.
This boils down to a tax fairness issue. We're not threatening adequacy in the state. It was unfairly stated that, hey, this would affect other school districts, and that is not true. There is no district in the state of Arkansas that will gain $1 from this decision, and no district that will lose $1 as far as when it comes to foundation-level funding. So it is about local tax dollars that people work and pay, generated locally, you know, being remitted back to the district that they originated from, just like what the law says.
In any case, the four districts remain under the gun to pay back $2.6 million by mid-June. Eureka Springs Superintendent Wayne Carr.
And so they called us in the middle of a budget year. There's very little I can do to cut my budget. So, again, I'm not sure where this is going to lead at this point, but for sure, you know, we're going to fight this all the way down to the very last day.
And if Brian King's bill fails, do you think you're going to work to circulate a statewide petition for an initiated act, or what do you think might happen next?
I think that's a possibility. I think a referendum might be a possibility. But still, we've got legislation to look at. We've asked the Attorney General to revisit this opinion, and also looking at the court system. So we still have some avenues to explore, and we think in the end that we'll be successful with that, because there's a big issue here. The concept is, do local taxes stay local? And that's going to be the biggest issue, I think. If we have to send our local tax money to the state, it will be very difficult for school districts to ever ask for a millage increase again, because people are not going to raise their local taxes just to send it to Little Rock. That's going to be another big issue that the entire state will have to deal with if this does come about.
So just in case, Wayne Carr is reportedly considering not replacing retiring staff and finding ways to spend less on facilities upgrades and utilities. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
An update on a story from last week on Ozarks at Large. Sheffield Nelson, the two-time GOP nominee for governor in Arkansas, will have to resubmit his ballot proposal for an increase on the severance tax applied to natural gas. Yesterday, Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel rejected the wording of the proposed ballot measure, saying it was not clear enough describing where the money would be directed. Nelson has said the money raised by an increased tax would be applied to local and state roads and highways. He can rewrite and submit a new ballot proposal to the Attorney General. If that is approved, supporters would still need to collect thousands of signatures of registered voters to have the question on the November 2012 ballot.
Ozarks at Large is supported by War Eagle Mill, offering a crepes-making cooking class Saturday, February 26th, with guest instructors from Crepes Paulette. More information is available at wareaglemill.com. Support is also provided by Walton Arts Center and Irish folk music group The Chieftains, performing this Sunday, February 27th. This tour marks the Chieftains' first return to the U.S. following the release of their 2010 album, San Patricio. Tickets and more information at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
This is Ozarks at Large. You can probably quickly recite the four presidents on Mount Rushmore. Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Roosevelt are among the most iconic leaders in the country's history. Beginning today, we'll have a series on what other Mount Rushmores might look like. P.J. Hrabowski asked different experts in the area whom they would choose to be immortalized. The rules were simple. You can pick four and only four figures to be included, just like the real Mount Rushmore. For this first segment, P.J. asked Julie Oliver, an assistant professor of history at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith, which four American women she would give Mount Rushmore status. She began her selection with the second-ever First Lady of the U.S., who also happened to be the mother of the sixth president.
My first choice is Abigail Adams.
She cared about women's rights, you know?
Absolutely, and she had a forum to express that to some of the leading figures in the founding of this country, the men that we think of as the founding fathers, not only her husband, and the reason we have this wonderful legacy, and we know what she thought was she wrote extensively. It was mainly through personal correspondence with her husband.
Right.
But one thing that stands out to me about her is, and that I always found absolutely fascinating, was that she had some correspondence also that we have access to with Thomas Jefferson as well. And this was not frivolous discussion. It wasn't about household matters. It wasn't a romantic writing of any kind. It was actually also talking about some of the things she would share with her own husband and her concerns about the country and the founding of the country, the state of the country, women's rights, the rights of African Americans, the slaves in the country. And so you have somebody like Jefferson you don't really think of him in connections with women's rights at all. But maybe her husband was a little biased. He is her husband, so she can have this give and take with him. He knew her intimately. Mm-hmm. But when she has this discussion with Jefferson, I think that gives it a little bit more objectivity because she is obviously recognized by him for having a tremendous intellect.
Okay, now why was she – these were letters to Jefferson?
Yeah, there's some correspondence.
So how did did this come about? Were they just good friends? Were they friends through her husband?
Yeah, mainly friends originally through her husband. They meet in connection with the Continental Congress as they were both representatives sent there, the first and the second Continental Congress. So the correspondence, the friendship that she would maintain with her husband when he was separated from her. She remained at home in Massachusetts, and he would be in Philadelphia. That correspondence is a rich legacy that's been left between her and her husband. But as the country is formed and then Jefferson and Adams have to take on new roles after the signing of the Declaration of Independence and there are periods of time, occasions when the two have a chance to meet. Jefferson's daughter has been sent to stay with the Adams family in Massachusetts for a time as he travels to Europe. Mm-hmm. And so they became acquainted that way. And then later when Abigail Adams joins her husband in France, when they're trying to secure French support for the revolution and monetary support and military support, she obviously has a lot of contact with him at that time as well. And I'm not familiar with all the times after that point, but they had met personally. But there are also some letters, and we don't know exactly the exchange that happened in the real time in person. But some of these letters, correspondence exist, and he obviously admired her intellect. And that stands out more than her correspondence with her husband, which you might think would be expected almost.
From Abigail Adams, who would be next on your list?
Well, this was a hard decision for me because when we had talked previously, we had both mentioned the suffragettes. And that particular effort to get women the right to vote was a long-fought one. But the reason I couldn't narrow it down to one woman is because I think there were so many women who were pivotal in that. Yeah. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, of course. They're some of the most famous names. But there was also other women Mary Elizabeth Lease, and she was from Kansas and was active in the populist movement in the late 19th century. But that movement also supported women's suffrage, and she was known as a great orator. But because she's from Kansas, she's not as well known as those more connected Eastern ladies.
That's what I was going to say.
Also, there's an African American suffragette. She was much more than that. However, her name was Ida B. Wells, and a journalist and author. She was exposing the terrors of lynching that were going on after the Civil War, kind of almost an epidemic of lynching in the United States against targeting African American population. But she was also a suffragette. She mm-hmm. she believed that women need the right to vote. So there were so many women. I really couldn't narrow that choice down.
We have to narrow that down to a movement.
Yeah. I think. And that a lot of women were very involved in.
Thank you for that, too, by the way.
So then my choice would be then somebody whose national prominence kind of stands out differently would be another first lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. She is really still, I think, the only activist first lady we've had. She supported the New Deal policies of her husband, social welfare issues, again, the plight of African Americans and other poor peoples in the United States. And she didn't just express this verbally or in writing. She actually goes out and visits in Appalachia. She visits towns and meetings that were being held by African Americans, and she got a lot of flack for that.
Okay, right. So we have two first ladies, Abigail Adams and Eleanor Roosevelt. What about the next woman? Would this be a first lady?
No, in this case, I've chosen somebody who I think is one of my personal heroes, but not connected directly with politics in any way.
And that's okay.
Rachel Carson. Her story, she was a very bright young woman and really interested in, discovered she's interested in the sciences. And so in an age when not many women went into the sciences, she goes into higher education, receives, I believe the highest degree she ever received was, in fact, a master's in the sciences and biology. Mm-hmm. And she starts her career with the U.S. government, working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And this is in the 1950s, primarily after World War II, and through her research, she was observing, mainly on the fish specimens that they would be collected, and that's part of their work in that service. And she was noticing disturbing anomalies and abnormalities in the fish.
Okay.
And so she becomes very concerned about this, and she starts doing the research to try to trace where this was coming from. That was her job. She'd been paid to do this. And her conclusion in the end is that that it's directly connected with, in particular, the post-World War II chemical industry. We had gained so much technical expertise in that area through World War II as military mm-hmm. conflict sometimes promotes the innovative and inventions and innovative science in the modern time, and that's focused in the military realm at first, and then it comes into the private sector following World War II. So this is kind of where she traces the problem, and that as these companies are producing these chemicals, that the detritus is being emptied into the waterways. Much as in earlier time period, industrial logging was polluting the waterways and ruining watershed for agriculture production and et cetera. But in this case, she's seeing these disturbing chemical reactions that apparently have been taking place in the fish population.
As a must marine be biologist, yeah.
So she puts all this together, and then she's going to stress that, well, this is not just going to the fish. This is obviously in the groundwater.
Was she one of the first people to actually bring this to the public,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And the way she does it in the end is she is called to speak publicly in different forums about this, but the main way that this information is communicated to the general public is her writing a book called Silent Spring.
Right.
So you might call her a kind of whistleblower. I don't think in this case she didn't work with the company she was working with, what was supposed to be an objective source and a branch of the government, an agency of the government, and that's what their job was to monitor these things. And you'd think she would have gotten a little bit more support from them. Historical terms, we say, yes, she was certainly maybe the first official environmentalist or starts the environmental movement.
So now we have three women on Mount Rushmore. Now we need one more. We've got to kick off the presidents and put on the first ladies and the women scientists. And who do we have next?
Well, the fourth choice was awfully difficult, and I did want to move into more recent times, but as a historian, I still stay in the past. But I finally decided on Krista McAuliffe, who was not the first woman astronaut. She was not the first woman scientist. She was kind of represents the rest of us in my mind.
She was a teacher.
She was a teacher and had been chosen of one of about 1,100 women to be the first teacher that would be trained as an astronaut, a payload specialist, and then she would go into space, and then she was going to take that experience, and then she was going to bring that back to her students and to her classroom and become a better teacher and help her students learn. And her being a teacher, the kind of the unsung heroes right now, is not a very good time overall for teachers in the K through 12 setting. I think they're taking a lot of bad press right now at all, you know, many levels. And I work with teachers daily basis, training them. And so I have a little bit of a soft spot for our teachers in the public schools. I know it's a tremendously difficult job. So if you look at Kristen McAuliffe being a teacher and the history of teachers in the United States, it's really as early as the 19th century that you have women taking over the teaching profession, the feminization is called of teaching. Mm-hmm. And it was really done, it was on purpose. It was a strategy by many school boards and leaders in education for using women, paying them less money, and yet they were wonderful teachers. Mm-hmm. And so even by that point, you have 70% of the teachers being women. And so,
women.
You know, she represents women and the teachers, and also, you know, the middle class, as it were. Maybe the other ladies were a little had more exotic. Mm-hmm. Backgrounds. I think her background is not exotic until we get to this, her being chosen as an astronaut. And maybe we would even, truth is, has she just gone through the mission and it been successful and the tragedy hadn't happened and she died in the shuttle explosion, that we would almost have forgotten her name because she was just a teacher.
Well, I just love the fact that you are recognizing women. You know, just thank you for Mount Rushmore. So today, the women on Mount Rushmore will be Rachel Carson, Abigail Adams, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Krista McAuliffe. Now, these are the opinion of Julie Oliver, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Arkansas, Fort Smith. And Julie, I want to thank you so much for coming in today and doing this. And we really, I hope you come back again. We can talk more about women's history.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks,
you so
Julie.
Thanks so much for having me.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm PJ Hrabowski.
Our series of Mount Rushmore ruminations will continue Friday when PJ talks to professor and journalist Hoyt Purvis about the four American sports figures he'd nominate for the honor. That's on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large.
Come away with me in the night.
8 years ago on this date, Norah Jones won 5 Grammy Awards for the album Come Away With Me, tying the record for a female artist that has since been broken by Beyoncé. Jones was born March 30th, 1979, in New York City. She's the daughter of legendary Indian musician Ravi Shankar. Jones grew up in Grapevine, Texas with her mother. After singing in church choirs and taking piano lessons, she attended Dallas's Booker T. Washington High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. After winning Downbeat's Student Music Award for Best Jazz Vocalist and Best Original Composition, Jones majored in jazz piano at the University of North Texas, where she sang with a jazz band called Laszlo. 2 years later, in the summer of 99, she moved to New York's Greenwich Village after becoming inspired by local musicians to write her own songs. There, she waited on tables and sang jazz standards in local clubs, often appearing with the funk fusion band Wax Poetic. After pulling together her own group, Jones signed to Blue Note Records in early 2001. Her debut album, Come Away With Me, won 5 Grammy Awards in 2003, including Best New Artist, Album of the Year, and Song of the Year for the hit Don't Know Why. She continues to perform and record, and in 2007, Jones ventured into acting, starring in the film My Blueberry Nights.
Come away with me in the night.
On this date in 1835, at the age of 25, Meriwether Lewis Randolph, a grandson of Thomas Jefferson, was appointed by President Jackson to be the Secretary of the Arkansas Territory, replacing William S. Fulton. Despite his strong connections with many influential families in Virginia, as well as intimate friendships with numerous U.S. presidents, he chose to settle on the Arkansas frontier. He obtained thousands of acres of land in Clark County with the intent of establishing a plantation and making his residence there. His education, family, and social ties offered great promise to the new state, but his contributions were cut short by an early death. President Calvin Coolidge signed a bill creating the Federal Radio Commission, forerunner of the Federal Communications Commission, on this date in 1927. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. You can pick up your free Washington County map right now at KUAF. This year's map features a full city map of Fayetteville. Just come to our studio at 9 South School Avenue in downtown Fayetteville and pick up your 2011 Washington County map today.
In the music business, it's often about labels, signing a deal with a record label or labeling your style of music. When it comes to the latter, singer-songwriter Kevin So says the inspiration for his sound comes from several artists in a variety of genres.
I guess I would describe it as like if James Taylor, Billy Joel, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, and Bruce Lee all had a godchild, they would be me. I don't know. But that is, I guess those are some of my major influences. But I also love Keb Moe and also the Roots, you know, Big Bill Brunsey, even you know, pioneers of art, you know, like comedy, Richard Pryor, Bill Hicks. I kind of fuse a lot of those things into one thing, but when you hear my music, there are subtle influences in a lot of those things, you know. Some would just call it folk, you know. I just kind of call it a hybrid of blues, folk, and soul. That's kind of the way if I were to kind of put it into a category, I guess that's what I would call it, and I would love it if people can kind of give it a chance and see what I'm doing, you know, as just, you know, sort of an Asian American, I don't know, I've been compared to like an Asian American Stevie Wonder or Asian American Bob Dylan, which is completely so different in some ways, you know. Bob Dylan, to most people's eyes, is like on the other side of the world from Stevie Wonder, but, you know, they what they're actually saying in their music is very similar, you know, and I kind of put that in my music too.
So we'll play an all-ages show at 7 p.m. February 27th at Teatro Scarpino in Fayetteville. The guitarist, who is now based in Nashville, Tennessee, last visited Northwest Arkansas when he opened for Keb Moe at the Walton Arts Center last February. So says he and the blues guitarist have been friends for more than a decade.
We just have a great musical chemistry, I think. Our roots are very common. I mean, he's a few years older than me, but I love the same stuff that he loves. And our backgrounds are very similar, too, just him coming from a more of a rhythm section side man. And I've been, you know, him as a guitar player, but me as a keyboard player.
Over the years, So has learned to play a variety of instruments, including the violin and harmonica, but he first got his start tickling the ivories as a child.
I started off on the piano, like every a good obedient Chinese American kid growing up in the 80s. I took the classical piano and then I took the violin. But you know, some kids do it reluctantly. My parents didn't force me to play the piano. My brother and sister were taking piano lessons and I kind of felt left out. You know, we used to live on a dead end street in Alston, Massachusetts, you know, a little town just on the outskirts of Boston. And we lived on a dead end street and we used to just play out in the street, you know. Summertime, you know, just play kick the can or, you know, hockey, you know, street hockey with a tennis ball, roller skates, that kind of thing. And my brother and sister would get called up to play piano lessons, and then I kind of felt left out. So I just asked my sister to show me something on the piano, and I was off and running.
Among So's varied repertoire is a hip-hop song that has provided him with an interesting nickname.
Well, I have this hip-hop song that I wrote about 3 years ago. I put out an album called The Brighter Day. And there's a song on there called The New Sensation, a.k.a. Sexy Asian Man. And it's kind of a fantasy type of you know, Kanye West, Outkast influence, over-the-top superhero fantasy about this Asian American huge star. Now this is 2007, so you take somebody like a Bruno Mars today, you know, who's very popular and to me very clearly Asian American, and it's, I guess it was sort of prophetic in that way. Not to sound vain in any way, but the sexy Asian man, that's kind of the root of it. And there's a line in the song basically saying, "It's that sexy Asian. You know, it's the new sensation, kicking it across the nation. You know, it's that sexy Asian." That's the hook. And it seems to have stuck because it became one of those pieces in the musical that we're working on. So people seem to like it. I find it interesting just to hear people's reaction to it, you know.
In addition to performing concerts, So has also dabbled in the world of theater. He composed the songs for a semi-autobiographical musical called Great Wall, which was the recipient of the 2007 New York City Fringe Fest Award for Best Music and Lyrics. It's currently in development with Tony Award-winning playwright David Henry Hwang.
A big, I guess, cornerstone in the show that I do on this tour is, I call it a Victor Wu medley, and it's all on the piano. It's about a 13-minute medley of songs that are taken from this musical that I'm currently working on, which is called Great Wall. And, it's a medley of songs that highlight this sort of journey of this Asian-American kid named Victor Wu, who's trying to become the first Asian or Chinese-American rock star in the 80s.
Sunday's show will be a solo acoustic performance that So says will be very intimate and feature a wide selection of his songs.
They can expect to hear some blues, some jazz, they should expect to laugh, to cry, to think, and to just enjoy. You know, I think it's going to be an experience, a very special experience. I'm excited. I've been playing shows since January 22nd and kind of in the middle of my tour right now, a 3-month tour, which is the longest tour I've ever done in my life. And I'll be hitting places all around the country. And this is going to be I feel kind of right now, it's just really primed and ready. I've been warmed up and my shows are going extremely well. And, I'm also working in new material. So people can also expect to see works in progress and to see first glimpses of songs that will be on my next album.
Tickets will be sold at the door. Concert details are available at 479-409-3772 or scarpino.com. More information about the artist is available at kevinso.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Good evening to you. I hope you had a nice day. I'm here to keep you company. Do you mind if I play? I'll sing for 30 minutes. Maybe by then my time is done. I'm out to prove I'm second to none.
Joining me now in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Laura Kellums, Northwest Arkansas Director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, who is hosting the 10th Annual Soup Sunday this Sunday, February 27th. And so how do you guys feel to be doing, you know, the 10th one after a decade of this, and it's still going?
The great thing about Soup Sunday is that it started even before our Northwest Arkansas office did. Our Northwest Arkansas office opened in 2008, and we had this group of volunteers that for years before that had been producing this fundraiser just to support this organization that was based in Little Rock because they felt so strongly about the work that the organization was doing. So Soup Sunday actually predates the office here and my being with Advocates. So
absolutely,
I think it's great that it's been going for 10 years. It just shows you how strongly people feel about the work that we're doing.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you guys do.
Sure. Arkansas Advocates is an organization that's based in Little Rock, and we do public policy work and research on behalf of kids and families. And one way to explain that is to just tell you, like, the product, one of the products of our work, the Our Kids First health insurance program, mm-hmm. that 70,000 kids have health insurance through a part of the program that we helped create in the late 90s. And so that's one of the best things, is just to tell people what it is that we have produced, I guess. So what we do is we essentially lobby on behalf of some of the most vulnerable kids and families in the state, kids who live in poverty, can't call their lawmakers and get them to vote a certain way, their parents who are working on the line at a local factory or plant aren't necessarily in a position to go to Little Rock and testify on a bill that will affect them. And so what we do is provide that voice for them. They're oftentimes the voiceless people in our state, the most vulnerable kids, children of immigrants, children of our poorest families in the state. We stick up for them when public policy is being made. We make suggestions about what other states are doing that might be successful and what we could take advantage of in Arkansas and the ways we could serve those families better.
And the organization has been based out of Little Rock for decades, and then you guys moved up here to Northwest Arkansas. Well, you have a new branch here in Northwest Arkansas. So how did that come about, that they wanted to expand that to this area?
Sure. It goes back to those volunteers that I was talking about, who are longtime board members up here and others who have felt strongly for since the 80s that we needed to have an office here. Arkansas Advocates was started in 1977 by a group of people who essentially thought those folks I was talking about don't really have a voice when public policy is being made in Arkansas. And so it's always based there, and we're the first satellite office. And so those same people who have felt strongly about our work pushed to get an office up here. And it makes a lot of sense, even though we're supposedly the wealthy part of Arkansas.
Right.
Our child poverty rate is growing really fast, faster than it is in other parts of the state. And even during our most prosperous years of growth in this region, our child poverty rate was growing very quickly. And it's those kids here need a voice just as much as the kids in the rest of the state do.
So Soup Sunday will help raise money for your organization so you can help, you know, give those people those voices. So can you tell me a little bit about the event?
Sure, sure. Soup Sunday, it's been going on for 30 years in Little Rock, 10 years here. Local restaurants, dozens of local restaurants donate soup and bread and desserts and cheese and other yummy items. And they serve, some of the restaurants serve those. We volunteers serve some of the soups. And there's just, more than 30 different types of soup. And people can just go around and take little samples of all the different kinds of soup and take basically as much as they want and taste all the kinds that they want. And you'd be surprised, you get full on that soup. And the tickets are $20 and $5 for kids. And it's a really laid-back, casual, fun time. You don't have to get dressed up. Your kids are welcome. The kids run around, and there's a band, and the kids run around and have a good time. And it's 4:30 to 7 on Sunday at the Convention Center in Springdale, which is on 48th Street. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a good time for families to get together and have dinner, or for people to have a snack on their way somewhere else.
So they can just stop by for a little bit, and they don't have to stay for the whole time.
Right.
If they
when
don't
you
want
have
to.
A ticket, you don't have like a reserved spot at a table or anything. It's sort of a come and go. And so it's like you could stay the whole time and, you know, hang out with your friends, or you could come by for just a little while and leave. But we have some great soup types. I could tell you
yes,
some of
please.
The donations. One of the most popular ones is always the Cafe Rorleans has crawfish
yes.
corn bisque that she makes. Hog House and Common Grounds always have really great offerings. They've been very supportive of us from the beginning. They're having black bean soup and winter vegetable and barley. And there's just all kinds of mouth-watering soups from lots of different types of restaurants in the area, from Fayetteville to Bentonville.
And you said there will be music, live music, and who's yeah. providing that this year?
It's a great volunteer band called the McFetridge Jazz Quartet, uh-huh. and they've been doing this for years, and they just have a good jam session and have a good time, and the kids run around in front of the band and have a good time. So,
now, is there also a silent auction?
We do have one item that we're going to auction. That's a pair of earrings that Blakeman's Fine Jewelry and Rogers donated, but we don't have a big silent auction like we've had in years past. We just have the one item this year.
Excellent. So why should people come to this event? It's a little different than some of the other fundraisers we have going on, but that's kind of what makes it fun.
Yeah, actually, I think that is why people should come. I mean, not only is it a great price for your whole family to be able to come in a casual time where you don't have to get dressed up. But it's also a way to support a lot of different organizations at once in Northwest Arkansas. We work in partnership with almost every nonprofit in the region that serves children. Our work that we do at the state capitol and in Congress actually supports the work that they do. For example, when we make strides in children's health care through public policy, that supports Arkansas Children's Hospital. That supports the other hospitals in our area. It supports the Children's House when we win on a foster care issue, those type of things. So it's actually supporting Arkansas Advocates is a way of supporting all of the organizations in Northwest Arkansas.
All right. So like we said, tickets are $20 for adults, $5 for kids. And how can they get those?
You can go on our website at aradvocates.org or call my office, 927-9800. And there's also tickets available at the door. You can avoid the line by calling early, but you can buy them at the door as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Laura.
Thanks, Antoinette. I appreciate it.
Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Arcom Printing, located east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711 for more information. Support is also provided by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. You're listening to KUAF Public Radio, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Waldron.
This is Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I should point out that, yes, Laura Kellums, who Antoinette interviewed earlier in this program, is my wife.
Yes.
But
he had nothing to do with it. I set it up with her.
I had nothing to do with the scheduling, the question creation, editing.
None of it. I did
it
all.
Interview. That's right.
Not you.
So there's the disclaimer.
Are you happy about your ethics now?
I am indeed.
Okay.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Back tomorrow at noon with a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.